Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Intellectual History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name's Alexandra Ortolia Baird, and I'm a host of the channel. Today, I'm talking to a historian who I'm sure needs no introduction, Professor Dan Edelstein of Stanford University, about his recent book on the spirit of rights, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2018. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
And I can say, having just read the book, that it's a real delight to have you and a real pleasure to talk about the book. I'm very, very excited for this. So we like to always start our interviews by just easing guests in, so to speak, and just asking for you to tell us a little bit about yourself and how your academic trajectory kind of led to the book as it stands.
Yes, well, I think my academic trajectory would be challenging to try and chart it using any known mathematical equations, since it doesn't really seem to have a very regular path. My background is actually in literature, so I have a PhD in French literature, and in fact, when I started my PhD, I thought I was going to be working on 20th century poetry, but somehow I fell down both the chronological rabbit hole. Spending most of my graduate years working on the 19th century, but then realizing as I was doing stuff on the 19th century, I was at the time very interested in sort of the role of mythology as a sort of form of knowledge in the 19th century, just came to realize that everything always goes back to the French Revolution. And then sort of ended my graduate work on the French Revolution. And so my dissertation is really this sort of unholy mess that looks a bit like, I don't know, maybe the fall of Icarus could be an appropriate metaphor. Luckily, I don't think anyone ever read it. So that was sort of how I initially became interested in both in history and then more particularly in intellectual history. And then ended up writing my first book on the terror of the French Revolution, and already was looking at questions around natural law. But actually, in that book, I was more interested in the book is called The Terror of Natural Right, and I wasn't really looking at rights. I was natural right is the sort of awkward English translation of what in French would be le droit naturel, like you would talk about le droit civil, so the sort of the body of civil law, the body of natural law. We don't really use right in that original sense very much in English. But in fact, it does go back to this ambiguity in Latin. And the two ways in which is used, if you go back, in most Roman sources, jus would similarly refer to sort of the body of laws around a certain topic. So there's jus naturale, there's jus civilis, so civil law, natural law, jus gentium, which would become law of the nations for us in English, And then, of course, there's the famous shift or a bit of a controversy over when exactly this happens. Was it already used in Roman times, or did this is this really a modern development where use also becomes the word for an individual right. So this is the debate over sort of this, the objective and subjective meanings of use. And we still, you know, we still have that that very same ambiguity in French, you know, le droit civil, le droit naturel, but also mon droit and les droits de l'homme. So droit is both operating in the sort of objective and subjective sense in French as well. And so the, you know, this is sort of a long-winded way of saying sort of how I had done all this work on the sort of body of natural law and on the natural law theorists and their the way in which they get appropriated during the French Revolution and especially during the Terror. But I hadn't really looked that specifically at the question of rights, both in terms of how rights were treated by these earlier natural lawyers and then how they are how they play out during the French Revolution. And that's really what this this recent book is about.
And it's interesting that you say that everything comes back to the French Revolution, because I think that's something that we'll come back to later in the interview. But before we do that, could you just outline perhaps what were your main driving motivations behind the book? So you've kind of explained how you got there, but what was really, really pushing you forwards in that argument? And perhaps you could also just reflect or tell us a little bit about how you came to the title, which I'm sure for many intellectual historians is incredibly satisfying. So it would be great to hear your kind of thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's such a modest title, you know, when you riff off of Montesquieu and the spirit of laws. Well, so I guess there were multiple. So the book kind of as it it took a long time to write. Actually, I thought this was going
to
be
they tend to.
They do tend to, yeah. Although my second book was actually quite short, and it was a very satisfying experience, actually, just sort of writing a book that's essentially just an extended essay. And I thought, oh, maybe I could pull that off here as well, because there isn't actually really a good short monograph on the Declaration of the Rights of Man, and at least in English. There's hundreds of them in French, but there wasn't really one in English. So I thought, oh, I could just try to do that. But yes, there were a number of factors that sort of led me down this. So one of them was sort of a sense of that there was a real gap in the secondary literature on the history of rights. And there was a gap between sort of the scholarship that had come out in the 70s and really all the way up until the bicentennial of the French Revolution, on the one hand, and then the more recent books, really starting with Lynn Hunt's book on inventing human rights, and then Samuel Moyn's book on The Last Utopia. And the gap was that all of the earlier scholarship really tended to focus on the early modern period and even the late medieval period. So this is sort of the work of people like Michel Villet in France, but also Leo Strauss, later Richard Tuck, and then even going all the way up to people like Brian Tierney, who's actually one of my favorite historians of natural rights. But they're all looking at, you know, the sort of the action for these scholars takes place between roughly, you know, the 12th century, and maybe they'll go up to the 17th century. But really, the die is cast pretty early for almost all these scholars. And then conversely, with Lynn Hunt and Sam Moyn, it's like nothing happens before 1700 at the earliest. And of course, you know, Sam's famous sort of argument that really nothing happens before 1970, which I think he's since revised copiously. But this had this effect of sort of suggesting that, you know, the incredible amount of intellectual effort that went into theorizing natural rights in the sort of natural law tradition, which had been the focus of all this earlier scholarship, just kind of gets ignored by the more recent scholarship. I mean, I think that, Lynn Hunt has sort of I think come around a little bit to mollify her earlier position. But in Inventing Human Rights, she sort of, you know, fairly casually says, yeah, well, all of, you know, natural rights had too many meanings. We can't really, you know, look to this history in order to understand the emergence of human rights in the 18th century because it's just too messy. Interestingly, that's kind of an 18th century position. You do find a lot of philosophes, you know, waving their hands at Pufendorf and Grotius and say, ah, you know, quel fatras, you know, what a bunch of confusing claims that we find there. But to me, this just felt like that couldn't be the case, right? I guess I'm also, I think there, you know, there are splitters and lumpers in intellectual history, and I've come to realize that I'm probably more of a lumper than a splitter. And so it just seemed that there had to be some continuity here. It just didn't make sense that people would be using basically the same terms, using the same arguments, and not being any connection with the philosophers who came before. So that's really what the book tries to do, is try to stitch together the early modern and the modern. And of course, you know, that's the sort of effort when you try to do something like that, you're kind of bound to do each part. You're bound to fail on each side. But hopefully there is at least some, you know, establishing some bond between these two parts.
And you say something really wonderful. It really struck me as just a fantastic phrase that, you know, I really tell to students, which you say, downplaying historical novelty does not downplay historical importance. And I think that really lends itself to this kind of long-term view, this lumper rather than splitter view. But what you've said leads very nicely into just something that I wanted to ask you about, who you see as the audience or audiences, plural, of the book, because, you know, rights naturally crosses over fields. You know, it's history, of course, but, you know, there's also law and political theory. You know, did you have a particular audience in mind, or do you see this being a book that really transcends those?
So, I mean, I guess every author hopes that they are writing for the largest possible audience. I mean, I think that you're right that it's a book that people from very different fields may well stumble upon, just because if you're doing research on rights, then you know you could be coming from political theory, you could be coming from law, from history. It's interesting. I feel that I'm more and more in dialogue with people who actually are in sort of the history of political thought world, which in the UK, you still find a lot of those scholars in history departments. But in the US, more and more, the people I'm in dialogue with actually are in political science departments, because that's where political theory and the history of political thought live. And this says something, I think, more about our fields than really about anything that I know I'm doing. It's more that, modern intellectual history has been staging a real comeback, but early modern intellectual history seems to be having a slightly harder time in the history fields. And this is a really big, broad claim, and there's lots of exceptions. But I think that when you find early modern intellectual historians in history departments today in the US, they're probably more likely to be doing sort of history of science or cultural history. There's, of course, the whole sort of Anthony Grafton school, which is the history of erudition, which is still pretty hot. But it seems to me, and maybe this is just my misguided subjective view, but it does seem like there are fewer intellectual historians of political thought in history departments these days. So if I think like the people I tend to be reading and citing, well, most of them tend to be political theorists doing history of political thought. And it's very different in the UK, of course, with obviously the whole dominance of the Cambridge School, but even at Oxford, at Queen Mary. I mean, there's all of the sort of intellectual and political historians are very much ensconced in history. And so it does sometimes feel like, you know, this matters because, you know, a lot of historians will sort of be pushing back on like just the kinds of claims that intellectual historians will make. So like, for instance, I have a chapter on the theory of abolitionism. So like, and this gets us, you know, back to Montesquieu. How is it that these developments in rights contributed to abolitionism? But I'm not actually, you know, talking about the phenomenon of abolitionism, talking about ideas around abolition, sort of what fueled the arguments for abolitionists. And more and more I sense with historians, especially in the US, they'll sort of want me to say more about, well, you know, who were the people who were using these ideas? How did they actually play out in the process, you know, leading up to abolition? And, you know, those are great questions and fascinating questions. But it seems to me that you can sort of look at those questions, or you can also just sort of study how these ideas came about, and that you don't necessarily, that it's sort of not problematic to only do intellectual history. I guess I'm basically, you know, doing an apologia, you know, pro disciplina sua. But yeah, there's a lot of pushback, I find, still today, from other historians doing early modern intellectual history of political thought.
I like to think that some of those issues stem from the fact that intellectual history is so porous, and it can extend so nicely and so with such kind of grace into those other disciplines and fields. I try to always put a positive spin on it, because it does sometimes feel, as an intellectual historian, like it's this uphill battle of trying to convince people of why it's still not philosophy or not political theory, right, and so forth. Mm-hmm. But before we really dive into the book and go through some of the chapters, could you just briefly, for listeners, outline what the general structure is and how it progresses across the sections?
Sure, I can try at least. So I think, you know, what I realized as I was writing the book is that we need a new way to write the history of rights. So earlier in our conversation, I was referring to the sort of, you know, older generation of rights scholars, you know, going back to the 60s and 70s, Vidé, Strauss, et cetera, and all the way up to Tuck, really. Their story was precisely this sort of shift from the objective understanding of natural law, jus naturale, in the sense of there is a body of laws that are given to us from nature, and the shift to the subjective understanding of rights as a sort of an individual power, and that's sort of their story. You know, for Vidé and Strauss, it's a very negative story. The move from objective law to individual law is seen as this kind of fall, and it's a very anti-modern story. And then, you know, Tuck's first book, Natural Right Theories, sort of takes that same narrative but just flips it on its head and says, oh, this is great. You know, this is kind of becomes a triumphalist narrative of, you know, the growth of rights as a positive thing. And this is one of the reasons why I was saying I like Brian Tierney's work so much. I mean, Tierney really just savages that narrative and says, you know, it's nonsense, because essentially, you know, understanding jus naturale as a body of laws and understanding assume jus, my or his jus, as an individual power, it's kind of two sides of the same coin. If there's a natural law that says I shall not take your stuff, then, you know, using the language of legal philosophers, you know, correlatively, you have a right not to have your stuff taken. So you can't really parse these two notions apart. And furthermore, they just cohabitate. I mean, so even if you look at linguistic usage, you know, think about the Declaration of Independence, which of course has all the famous lines about unalienable rights, but it's in the name of, you know, the laws of nature and nature's God. So, you know, even a Jefferson is still sort of drawing these conclusions about natural rights from certain premises based on, you know, the existence of natural law as a, you know, theologically grounded set of norms. So you just it just doesn't work as an account of what's happening during, you know, the 500 years between the sort of Franciscan debates, which are often looked to as, you know, one of the first moments where jus really becomes sort of weaponized as a subjective individual understanding of a right, you know, all the way up to the French Revolution and beyond, all the way up to the Universal Declaration. So what's happening there? How can we tell the story of what's been, of all the changes, you know, between Occam and Hobbes and the Déclaration des Droits de l'Homme? And so the more I sort of sat on that question, just finally dawned on me. It was actually kind of a funny story about how this happened. Maybe I'll digress since you encourage digression.
We love digression. It's truly the best.
So I was at the at Princeton's University Center for Human Values for the year, which is really, it was a wonderful experience. And I got to be around all of these, you know, political philosophers, political theorists, historians. I mean, it was interesting because most of my friends at Princeton are in history and in the French department, but the center is really more in the realm of political philosophy. And I was giving a presentation, and I just sort of threw out fairly casually that, in Locke's second treatise, yes, you know, we start out in the state of nature with all these rights, but we have to give them up to society once we move into a civil, you know, political body. And Annie Stilt, wonderful political philosopher at Princeton, sort of said, no, we don't. And I thought I was just saying something totally obvious. Because for me, it is obvious, like in chapter 9 of the second treatise, you know, Locke literally uses that language. And Annie was just like, so from her perspective, I just said something totally idiotic. And, you know, I think since we still have a bit of a debate over what exactly we give up. But it made me realize that this seemed to be really the interesting question of not so much, do we have rights? Is there a concept of universal human rights that we can identify? Because frankly, you know, if you scratch the surface enough and if you sort of squint enough, you can pretty much see that concept definitely in the late Middle Ages. But, you know, arguably it is there even in antiquity as well. And so that didn't really seem like what's really happening, like what's at stakes during the long period of before the French Revolution, and, you know, all of the arguments that are going on in this field for, you know, for hundreds of years. They're not debating whether or not we have, you know, we have individual human rights, but what they're debating is what happens to these rights once we enter into society. And that's really what the book's about. And the way that this now allowed me to sort of propose a different way of telling the history of human rights was to show that there are really sort of three main options of what happens to human rights during once we leave the state of nature, or once we find ourselves in a political society. And interestingly here as well, and I won't go into this discussion fully, I'll just sort of allude to it, maybe we can talk about it later. I think that a lot of this is conditioned by Roman law and by the rediscovery of the corpus civilis in the late 11th century. But we can go into that later. But essentially, there are sort of these three positions, one of which is, well, you just retain your rights. So it doesn't really matter whether you're in a sort of state of nature or in civil society, rights are rights. And that will kind of ultimately become the standard view with, you know, following the age of revolutions. That's our assumption, like a human right, you've got it. It doesn't really you don't need to define the status that you're in, whether you're in a state of nature or not. But that actually was kind of the minority view for much of the early modern period. And the other two views were, on the one hand, what I end up seeing with Locke is that you have a sort of transfer narrative that, yes, you have these rights, but when you enter into political society, you have to transfer them to government. And essentially, you don't enjoy their use anymore. So you're not entirely stripped of them. You have not, you know, alienated your rights. But it's like when you deposit them into a trust, which is the fiduciary language that Locke uses. You can't just reclaim them under any circumstances. There's a very specific way in which you can regain your rights, which for Locke is if your government enters into a state of war with you, then you can regain them. But the rest of the time, you don't have them. And actually, I mean, this is, I think, perhaps the most controversial argument in the book, given the dominant libertarian reading of Locke. I don't think that you really even retain your property rights, your natural property rights in civil society for Locke, because you've had to you've transferred those to the government, and in exchange, the government gives you positive property rights, a deed to your land, which you can then trade, you can sell, you can buy up others. But all of the sort of Lockean stuff on labor and how we get property in the first place, kind of becomes irrelevant once you enter into a political society where there is no more virgin land for you to develop. So it might still apply in colonies, where apparently there's nobody, but it doesn't really apply anymore, say, to England. So that's the transfer argument. And then there's the more hardcore argument, which will become sort of favored by the absolutists, or those who are prefer a form of authoritarian government, which is, we all have these rights, but then, if we really want to have a working society, you just have to give them up completely. And that's, more or less the Hobbesian argument, that you just have to alienate these rights. The government takes them over. Now, Hobbes does sort of splice this and say, well, you don't give up your right to self-preservation and you can still try to escape prison. And there's a few minor differences that he allows. But the general model here is that you just completely have to hand over your rights, and you essentially become alienated from them. And this, Grotius will push forward this model, and others will as well. So the story then becomes sort of this competition, this rivalry between these three different models. And the sort of real interesting question I found is, well, if the preservation model is is seen as kind of crazy, really, and it's only the most radical thinkers who push this forward in the radical Huguenots, the Levelers, but sort of none of the really dominant philosophers of natural law take this very seriously until the late 18th century. Well, why is it? Why is it that that's the model, the regime, as I describe it in the book, that will ultimately dominate in the late 18th century and more or less continues to be the way that we think about rights today?
And so this format is really how the book begins. So you have the first chapter, which is called How to Think About Rights in Early Modern Europe. And that's when you present what you call these regimes of rights, which is perhaps something we can talk about later, but a very, very interesting way of thinking about them. And as you say, you have the preservation regime, the transfer regime, and the abridgment regime. And I very much enjoyed, as an intellectual exercise, trying to fit historical thinkers within those regimes. But something that you also, and it's again slightly tangential here, that you bring up in this first chapter is regarding methodology. And I say this just because as someone who's very interested in digital humanities, you talk a lot about how we can write and research intellectual history in the digital age. And you outline very clearly the limitations and the caveats of using tools like Google Ngrams, like databases like Ebo and Gallica. But you make what I think is a very, very strong case for how these tools could and should be integrated and used to bolster the intellectual history that we're writing, provided, however, that we're very cognizant of their biases and limits. So could you perhaps sketch out for those listening who are perhaps less familiar with these issues, you know, what some of the problems are in writing an intellectual history which relies so heavily on digital technologies and digital tools, but also the advantages that really come from that?
Yeah, sure. And it's a great question. I'm glad that you, brought this up. I mean, I think that, you know, we're all a little bit like Molière's Monsieur Jourdain, who discovers that he knows how to speak in prose. I think these days, just about everybody is making wide use of digital technologies. And it could be as simple as, you know, using Google Books, let alone Google Books, Ngrams, or downloading PDFs from Gallica. I think it's, you know, when I started doing digital humanities back in all the way back in 2007, it felt still like it was slightly a separate field, and I think that there's still people today who are really identify primarily as digital humanists, but a lot of the stuff that was sort of more unusual, you know, even just 12 years ago, has now sort of gone and become very mainstream. So things like word frequencies that you can get by using Google Ngrams or something like the wonderful Frantext database run out of the University of Chicago, these now, you know, are pretty, you know, run of the mill for a lot of intellectual historians, literary scholars, etc. Now, and so I think I'm sort of an advocate of, you know, let's go for the low-hanging fruit. You know, I spent many years involved in these sort of very complicated DH projects that required big grants and, you know, hiring computer programmers, and it was really exciting, but it left me feeling that, you know, there's so much work that has to go into doing these sort of more cutting edge DH projects, and when you have to, you know, clean up your data and acquire your data. I mean, you spend years and years, and you get, you know, you can get interesting results, but you do have to kind of question the amount of effort that goes into getting those results. And with, you know, it seems to me that we're still at a moment in sort of the history of digitalization where there's just so many low-hanging fruit that we can acquire easily without and just using sort of off-the-shelf tools. So that's my sort of general outlook, especially as an intellectual historian. And you know, I don't mean to say that there's not fascinating stuff you can do that is a little more sophisticated, like with topic modeling or mapping even. But you know, it's a lot. It takes a lot of work. So it's just a question of like, where do you want to invest your time and energy? Now, of course, there are caveats, and the caveats are that, you know, not everything has been digitized, and so the corpus that you explore when you're using databases like Ebo, Echo, Gallica, even Google Books, do have biases. I mean, sometimes those are the very biases that that libraries already have, but they could also be, to use the great language of the famous information theorist Donald Rumsfeld. You know, there are known unknowns and our unknown unknowns, and you know, some of the known unknowns are like, well, we know what tends to get collected. We know that certain voices tend to get left out. But then there are unknown unknowns, often there are some databases where it's really unclear what the principle of collection was. And so like with Google Books, frankly, I think it's a little bit the luck of the draw, but it is a big draw. So you have to be very wary that, you know, you can't use everything, or that you can't sort of, I think, reach hard conclusions often from any sort of statistical analysis of a database of old texts. Then there's also other challenges, like there's the whole so-called dirty OCR problem, which refers to the fact that, you know, most collections so the process for establishing, say, echo is that you, if you're lucky, you scan the original books. I think that echo, they might still have quite a few, the scanning process might have been on the basis of microfilms, I believe, but I'm not entirely sure about that. It was certainly the case for a lot of the texts on Gallica originally. But so already you can be starting with a pretty low quality image of the book, but most of the time the text, so if it's been digitized so that you can do word searches, that happens through a process called optical character recognition or OCR, which is very good these days if you take a contemporary book, you scan it, you run it through an OCR, you're likely to get 99.5% accuracy if you've done a really good job scanning it. But for 18th century, or let alone 17th or anything earlier, the accuracy goes way down. And so this is the so-called dirty OCR. If you haven't corrected the OCR, the optical character recognized text, then the problem is that maybe you're searching for rights, but it shows up as rifts in the text, and so you're doing a word search and you just don't find it. And that's really one of the biggest challenges for doing any kind of statistical studies of these corpora, because it could just be that you're not actually searching what you think you're searching, and that you're missing huge numbers of things. So those are like the biggest caveats. Then I guess I would say there's other issues that show up, like Echo has tons of duplicates, and so you might say, oh, look, there's this big surge in rights talk in the 1740s, but it turns out that that's just because there were like five editions of Locke's second treatise that were republished that year or that decade. So you have to be really cautious while using these tools. Now, what can you do with them? I still think that they're great for giving you kind of orders of magnitude, and something like Google Book Ngram is good for this too. So, remember when I was doing more DH stuff, I was working with a team on French Enlightenment networks, and we were doing some statistical studies, like sort of who was in the correspondence networks. And one of at the time, one of my graduate students came back with this beautiful chart, and all of the decimal point, all of the statistics had decimal points. I said, let's just have as a rule not to use decimal points, because we know our data is kind of loose anyway, and so like when you start adding decimal points, it gives us like this aura of scientificity, an aura of precision that we just actually really need to dispel. However, when you notice that there's like five times more or 10 times more of something in one category than another, that seems to be significant, right? Maybe we're still off by quite a lot, but we can deal with, pretty big margins of error if we're looking at these, major differences in magnitude. So I do use Google Ngrams in the book, and it's really to show there's this like big rise happening, like so in the chapter on the French Enlightenment, there really does seem to be something that's happening in the 1760s and 1760s and 70s that like rights talk really does explode. Is it two times more? Is it three times more? That doesn't really matter. It's more that this then becomes almost like a heuristic tool. It's sort of what in statistics they would call exploratory data analysis. It's like, there seems to be something interesting going on here. Let's go find out what it might be. So rather than using these DH tools to give us the answers, I'm a big advocate of using them to help us ask questions. and try and figure out, like, what's going on here? Is it just a data issue? Is it just that my sources, the sources in this database, are really biased, and that's why I'm seeing this? Or is it actually something interesting that's happening that I need to really now use, you know, my qualitative training as a reader of texts to figure out what it is that's going on here?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And I think the book does that so excellently. I think it really is a fantastic example for intellectual historians to look at, to see how they can mediate digital humanities and intellectual history for the positive and ask those new questions. So let's move further into the book and realize that we're keeping you already in chapter one. So you move in part one to really explore these various rights regimes that you've already mentioned. So you're beginning with a chapter called When Did Rights Become Rights? From the Wars of Religion to the Dawn of the Enlightenment. And here you're working through examples ranging from the Huguenot revolutionaries to the English levelers. You have Hobbes and Locke and Hutcheson. And I think what you make very apparent in this chapter is how this preservation regime that you've already mentioned of the late 18th century had, on the one hand, these very clear roots in much earlier theories, but on the other, was also relatively undeveloped in comparison to the other rights regimes that you bring up. But I'd like to jump a little bit forwards to chapter three in particular, as take my prerogative as host here, to ask you about the particular contribution to Enlightenment political discourse made by a group who I am very fond of, that being the physiocrats. So could you give listeners an overview of who the physiocrats were for those who are perhaps not familiar with them as a group, and also the very specific role that you have uncovered in this chapter with regards to the role that they're playing in the rights discourse of the 18th century?
Yes. Well, I guess we are both members of the Physiocrat Appreciation Club.
Not so many of us, but they're fantastic.
It's a very rarefied club. Well, and I think that one of the reasons I find them so interesting is that I feel like there's still so much to be gleaned from their contributions to political discourse. So maybe that's sort of how I can segue into, you know, a very brief introduction of the physiocrats. They themselves called themselves the economists, and they are still today mostly remembered and studied by historians of economic thought. They're sort of the very, you know, off the cuff description of the physiocrats is sort of like they're the precursors to Adam Smith. And that's typically how they're described in all of the history of, you know, capitalism literature. So they develop many of the ideas about the free circulation of grain. And so they're sort of the founders in some respects of, you know, the free market. Although, as you know, historians have shown, those ideas really go back to the 17th century, bizarrely to the Jansenists. But they really sort of try to carve out economics as almost its own discipline, and perhaps that's their greatest contribution, is, you know, fashioning this discipline. And of course, you know, Adam Smith is early on is, you know, fascinated by the physiocrats. I think at one point he meant to dedicate The Wealth of Nations to François Quesnay, who was the doctrinal fountainhead of physiocratic thought. And you know, their basic insight is that all wealth comes from the land, and that this is where their name physiocrats come from. So the rule of nature, and so you just need to sort of let nature do its thing, and all everything. There's like a natural order, a natural balance between in prices and in wages, and that. It's really, you know, what we today would sort of recognize as, you know, the invisible hand, you know, in Smith's terms of market relations. But they also in sort of developing this economic thought, they also put forward some really interesting principles of political thought. And that's the part that I'm so interested in. And part of it does come from the fact that it's much less studied than the sort of economic thinking of the physiocrats. And one of the other reasons why they're so appealing, they were so appealing to me, is as part of this sort of story of, well, what happens in the 18th century? Why is it that this, the preservation regime, the idea that we retain our rights, does end up sort of winning out over its rivals? The physiocrats were incredibly influential. I think you know, Michael Sonnenscher had this good line in an article on the physiocrats that, you know, they were so influential that even their opponents ended up sort of adopting their terms. So they really sort of set the debate around many of these questions about the economy. But I think one also can make that claim about, like, even their economic opponents often ended up adopting the way they talk about rights. So what is their main contribution? I focus a lot on Quesnay, who's a really fascinating and quite unusual figure. So he comes out of real poverty. I don't think he learns to read until he's 11. He has a very he's really self-educated, and so it's a very idiosyncratic background. You know, he's not like Voltaire and many of the other philosophes who've sort of, you know, gone through the traditional Jesuit college and have, you know, a pretty identifiable education. Quesnay is really all over the place. And then he becomes a doctor. He's a surgeon, actually, which is not as prestigious as being a real doctor back in the 18th century. But he's very successful, and he ends up being, you know, Madame de Pompadour's personal doctor. So she was the Louis XV's mistress. He's also one of the royal doctors. He's close to Louis XV, who admires him a lot and supports him. So he's really at the center of power in the mid 18th century. And then builds this school around him of other very influential people, the Marquis de Mirabeau being his closest collaborator. But actually, many, many of the philosophes are drawn into his influence. So I actually do a little bit of network analysis just to show how extensive the overlap was between philosophes who were so sort of active in Paris, and I sort of use the Baron d'Holbach's circle and all of Alan Kors's wonderful work on that group as sort of a evidence of you know, being at the heart of the philosophe group, but how many of those were also, you know, actively working with Quesnay and Mirabeau in promoting physiocratic ideas. So there's like a clear circulation, like a social history of ideas here that we can retrace. But I think what's so fascinating about Quesnay is that because he does not have a traditional education, it's not really clear that he's very familiar with many of the natural law thinkers of the 17th century, let alone anyone who came before. I think he does seem to know Hobbes, but rejects him. But he essentially is taking a much more traditional Aristotelian point of view. We know he did read Aristotle and was very influenced by the Politics. And then sort of, you know, updating it a little bit with more modern terms. And this is really important because, in a sense, what he's doing is closing the caesura that gets opened, you know, in the 17th century in particular, and Hobbes really separates these two parts as much as possible. And this is the caesura between a state of nature and a political society, and sort of making these to be absolutely different, you know, phases of human existence. And Quinet just goes back to the more traditional Aristotelian story of a sort of a gradual evolution of political society in which there is no sort of big bang moment where society is invented. We're always in society. You know, from the moment you're born, you're in a familial society. Families are part of larger groups of communities, which have their own social organizations. And, you know, the most developed forms of political society are simply, you know, extensions of what we find from the very beginning. So, no, it's just the traditional Aristotelian narrative. And there's no social contract. There's no moment where you sort of go from one to the other. And what this means is that, you know, the debate over what happens to rights when we enter into political society kind of ceases to even be one for Quinet. It's like, well, what could happen to them? We always have rights. That, you know, we're never moving from one phase to another. And so I think it's less that he sort of is successful in arguing against the other two models. It's just he sort of reframes the debate in such a way that the other two models or the other two regimes simply don't make sense anymore. And I think it's interesting because it really takes somebody who is very ill-versed in the history of natural law theory to make that move. Like someone like Rousseau, who is probably among the French philosophes who is the most knowledgeable about the natural law theory, you know, he ends up replicating the Hobbesian model and does not actually, you know, end up being one of the intellectual sources for revolutionary theories of rights. You know, with Rousseau, it is a kind of Hobbesian story, except with, you know, the sovereign is the people, but the people get to decide collectively which rights we have in a civil society. There's not really any carryover from the state of nature. It's almost like an alchemical transformation of rights. But Quinet, who like has, I think I found one mention of Hobbes, and so could even be like a secondhand knowledge of Hobbes, it's all just sort of thrown out the window. And this therefore makes up for a very strong case of, you know, no, you can only retain rights in political society. There's no other option.
And something else that I found just so fascinating in this particular chapter is the focus that you place on translations and textbooks and the role that they did or did not, I suppose is more correct, play in the revival of the natural law tradition in France. And you go through really fascinating examples of how translations and really translators as agents were affecting the dissemination of ideas and texts in the French-speaking world. And, you know, I'm thinking of people like Marc-Antoine Hadou, who I assume listeners might know more from his infamous translation of Adam Smith's Theory of Moral Sentiments, which then Smith went on to kind of blame for why he wasn't successful in the continent. But could you just briefly, for those at home, kind of give an idea of why it's so important to look at these translations as a kind of intermediary step in the history of ideas or concepts or intellectual history, however we want to define it?
Yeah, no, and thanks for, you know, for highlighting that, because it is so crucial in general, I think. Like I'm actually working on another project right now on the history of some intellectual history of revolution, and it all hinges on translations of Polybius that, you know, nobody really, people have studied, of course, the reception of Polybius, but people who study the history of revolution haven't actually looked at the role of translations in putting forward new terms and concepts. So in the case of rights, especially in the 18th century, I think it's interesting. Most of the people that I talk about in this book, read Latin and therefore could have read Pufendorf and Grotius and even earlier authors in the original language. But it's interesting. Often you'll find in the Encyclopédie, they'll refer to the Latin source, but actually, if you look closely, if you do some digital humanities stuff, you can find that they're citing the translation. So it's pretty clear that most people
were there.
Yeah, exactly. Right, as it's written in the Digest, and then we cite the English translation. So I think what's crucial here, though, is that the most important figure I'd say is Jean Barbirac. So Barbirac was a professor, a law professor. He was a Huguenot. He was at Lausanne for most of his career. And he translates both Pufendorf and Grotius, among others, into French. Now, what's crucial here are a couple of things. One is that he does Pufendorf first. So even though Pufendorf was writing much later than Grotius, his sort of reception into French actually sort of happens earlier than Grotius. But then what's really crucial is that Barbirac will also provide these extensive introductory essays that really frame the history of natural law in a very detailed and fairly ideologically driven fashion. So, people might be reading Pufendorf and Grotius, but they're still really getting Barbirac's perspective. He has extensive commentary and notes, often very critical. So, especially in his Grotius edition, he's often he'll cite the passages in Pufendorf that might be pushing back on Grotius. But also, it turns out that this is one of the ways in which Locke will be disseminated into France. So the second treatise is translated. I make the claim that it actually had a very limited impact in France in particular. And this also is a bit controversial, but most of the translations seem to be more connected with sort of the Huguenot exile community in the Netherlands. And someone like Voltaire, who does so much to promote Locke in 18th century France, doesn't ever refer to the second treatise, and even says some things that don't make sense if he believed that Locke had published the second treatise. So it's a fascinating reception story here. But Barbirac's footnotes do bring in a lot of Locke into his own criticisms of Grotius and Pufendorf. So it's a really crucial place to look for studying the dissemination of ideas and the transmission. They also mentioned textbooks, and here I'd just briefly flag Burlamaqui, who was also a law professor. He was in Geneva, and Burlamaqui his book, The Principles of Natural Right and then of Political Right, which come out around the mid-18th century, they would be incredibly influential, actually, even in the United States. They're translated into English and quickly sort of become part of law school curricula here. But they're kind of like a hodgepodge of a lot of the 17th century theory. So like the most critical view on this comes from Robert de Raté, who was a great Rousseau scholar, who really thinks that Burlamaqui is sort of basically just copy pasting a lot of 17th century stuff without attribution either. And some of that could be that these were largely lecture notes, and so it might not have been that he was trying to pass this off as his original ideas. Others have tried to show that Burlamaqui had a slightly more original view. I tend to find him to be a bit more on the hodgepodge side, and I get there by showing that in terms of these rights regimes, he's really all over the place. You can kind of use him to defend any one of them. Though I do think, you know, ultimately he tends to be a little bit more of a conservative. And indeed, that was definitely his politics within Geneva. He was aligned with the more aristocratic party in the Republic of Geneva. But all of this to say is that, yeah, these are incredibly important sources. And this is usually how most people would have been familiar with natural law thinkers. So, you know, Grotius and Pufendorf actually do have a pretty big, you know, they're cited a lot by the French, I mean, often quite critically, but that is because of Barbirac's translations. Should note that, you know, the English translations of Grotius and Pufendorf are, I think both of them are done on the basis of Barbirac's French translations, and they often will translate his notes as well. So there's sort of a double layer here of translation.
So you move then in part two to what you call social naturalism in early modern France. And you start this section by arguing that to understand 18th century conceptions of natural rights, we have to really retrace the parallel history of the laws of nature and nature's God. And you explore this natural history, this parallel history by first examining the laws of nature in Neo-Stoicism and science, and then moving to a chapter called Roman Law and Order from Free Market Ideology to Abolitionism. And I found this latter chapter especially captivating. And I was really convinced by your claims that the history of natural law discourses need to be better contextualized against the history of legal reform, which is something that we don't do a huge amount of. And there's so much to focus on in this chapter, but for the sake of time, I'd like to skip ahead to your sections which explore those connections between slavery, empathy, and human rights. And I was wondering if you could just outline to listeners some of the ways in which these issues were interacting and why views on rights and liberty were not necessarily lending themselves to abolitionism.
Yeah, well, there is a lot. There's a lot going on here. So one of the reasons I discuss empathy is because it's sort of at the heart of Lynn Hunt's argument in Inventing Human Rights, that it was sort of through the cultivation of empathy for those of a lower social status or of a different ethnicity that human rights came to be extended to all. And she credits the epistolary novel, especially novels like Clarissa, that sort of bring us into the minds of servants and would give us, essentially teach us to view others as fellow humans. Now, because I disagree with the sort of premise there that before the 18th century, nobody would have applied rights to everyone, I think just factually incorrect. I'm more skeptical of the sort of broader claim she makes, but I also think that the way that even in the 18th century people talked about empathy, Rousseau and Adam Smith in particular, they're pretty clear that it doesn't actually work that way according to them. For Rousseau, you know, the rich does not have empathy for the poor. You can only have empathy for those that you can kind of identify with. And then Smith has his famous thought experiment about, all of China could disappear and, you know, we would still be more worried about, you know, the cut on our hand. So I think that we have to be careful about how much work empathy can do in the 18th century. And you know, I'm happy to grant it a certain amount of work. And I think that, you know, Lynn's work is very, always very inspiring, and I'm sure that there's a lot that could be done there. But I think that if you actually sort of go back and trace how the abolitionist discourse developed, you will find a very different story. Most of the abolitionist scholarship points to Montesquieu as having this incredible role. So David Brian Davis's studies are crucial here, but it's true that all the abolitionists will cite Montesquieu over and over again, even though Montesquieu doesn't actually fully commit to abolitionism. And this is what's so fascinating about him. He kind of goes there and then at the last minute comes up with a kind of weird justification for why maybe in some extreme cases, like where it's really hot, it's still okay to have slavery. But That said, what's so crucial and fascinating about Montesquieu is again sort of how he reframes the thinking around rights to make slavery just impossible. And this does get to Roman law. And I think what's so interesting about Roman law, especially in France, is that, you know, we kind of tend to forget it as this other source of natural law thinking. It's not as sexy, right? Because it's not new. It's been there for thousands of years, and so it's also harder to think with, because it's not like somebody writes a book and then they sort of set the discussion. It's sort of always there. People are studying it and at the university. So how do we sort of integrate Roman law into sort of the more dynamic part of intellectual history? And what I think Montesquieu does is picks up on something that has been brewing from the late 17th century, really, and Hobbes and Pufendorf here are sort of crucial in this development. And the development is essentially collapsing the difference between the law of nations and natural law. So in Roman law, there are these three categories: civil law, natural law, and law of nations. And what was so brilliant about the Roman jurists is that they used the law of nations as a kind of corrective to natural law. So in Roman law, according to the law of nature, all men, all humans are equal. There is no slavery according to natural law. That's just not possible. However, as time goes on and human communities develop, we end up going to war with one another. In the context of war, prisoners are made. And because it is better to be allowed to live as a slave than to be killed as an enemy, slavery becomes permissible according to the law of nations. So this is how the Roman jurists justified slavery. But note that it's really crucial that they start off from the perspective that according to the law of nature, slavery is not legitimate. Now, in the late 17th century, this distinction between the law of nature and the law of nations really starts to collapse. And the idea that you could have some things in the law of nations that contradict what's in the law of nature just doesn't seem to make sense anymore. So Pufendorf, you know, it's called of the laws of nature and the laws of nations. I mean, he's really suggesting and explicitly arguing that the laws of nature are nothing more than the laws of nations are nothing more than the laws of nature's applied to political communities. And so they can't really anymore have a separate set of principles. And Montesquieu then very brilliantly sort of deconstructs now the whole Roman argument for slavery. So at the beginning of the famous book that deals with slavery, he starts by saying, you know, this whole Roman thing doesn't really make any sense. They want to separate the two, but actually we can't distinguish between the law of nations and the law of nature, and therefore what the Romans said about slavery is correct. It's illegitimate. You cannot have slaves according to the law of nature. So he actually just literally quotes the Digest in order to make the case that slavery is illegitimate according to the laws of nature. So it's a sort of like fascinating, almost like intellectual jujitsu, where he's sort of using the Roman and very, you know, canonical Roman case against slavery against the Roman justification for it.
In the final section of the book, you go on then to explore rights and revolution, the kind of culmination. So this is the rights and revolutions in the American and French context. And you interpret their respective declarations of rights less, and I'll quote you here, as fraternal twins than as faux amis, in which both granted the same natural rights of liberty and property, safety, and so on. But they interpreted the relationship between these rights and constitutional government in radically different ways. Could you just very broadly explain the essence of this fundamental difference and how it really came to be?
Yeah, so this is really, I think, where I was hoping to get with the book. And it's engaging on the one hand with a lot of the French scholarship on the Declaration of Rights. So people like Marcel Gaucher, who are quite critical of the French and sort of adopt almost a kind of Tocquevillian argument that the Declaration of the Rights was in many respects just sort of a continuity of French absolutism, this légicentrisme that they call it, that the French just can't get beyond sort of the central control of the state by the government, that this is just this like almost this is in the French DNA. And the flip side of this is like, there's a little bit of a rights envy, like, those Americans and those British, you know, they really know how to do rights. Like they make their rights strong and they don't say that the law has sort of the final say on everything. What I disagree with this view is that the French are the exception and that, you know, real countries have strong rights. I think it's actually the Americans and the English who are the exceptions here. And I don't mean that they're exceptional like due to some great genius of British of the British, but it's really the very exceptional path that law and legal forms take in England, which is just unlike anything we see on the continent. I'm referring not just to common law, but really to the way in which English common law will, thanks to all of the, all the messiness of English 17th century history, really will take on this very unusual set of criminal procedural rights. So these are, the rights against self-incrimination, the rights against warrantless seizures, pretty much everything that we now celebrate in the U.S. Bill of Rights, but that does not come out of either the Roman law tradition or the natural law tradition, for that matter, but has a lot to do with the specificities of English history and English law. And it's quite fascinating how the Americans, the American colonists, are absolutely clear about this. When you read even the Declaration of Independence or the state declarations that get written after 1776, it's like this sort of funny divorce statement where it's like, I hate you, but I really like your family. I want to keep all of the common laws, like the Maryland declaration that says like we're splitting up with you, English. You're very bad. You have a terrible king. But by the way, all English law continues to be operative in the country because that's great. And I think this is one of the reasons why it took the American colonists so long to reach independence, because they really valued being English subjects. And a lot of that was that they really valued English law. That's what you see in, say, James Otis's famous treatise on, the rights of, the British. It's about English law that he's so attached. So I think this gives the American declarations their very specific sort of the rights talk that you get in America is really mostly about English common law. And indeed, by the time of the Declaration, they no longer really need natural rights that much anymore. I mean, natural rights allow the Americans to make the claim that they can establish new government according to the principles that they choose. But, by the time of the 1787 Constitution, that's moot. And so all that you really see, there's no mention of natural rights, actually, in the U.S. Bill of Rights. And you can kind of read a little bit into the Ninth Amendment, but it's basically gone. Now, the French don't have that. They don't have this same, they don't have common law. They don't have, they have some customary law, but they don't have sort of, it's mostly a civil law country. And they have none of these kind of criminal procedural rights that the English have. And so you know, in a sense, I think it's a little unfair to project this sort of absolutist legacy onto the French revolutionaries. I mean, they clearly would like to have more criminal procedural rights, and they will ultimately go on to pass, you know, criminal justice, a new code of legislation, but they don't have that in 1789. And so when they are saying things like, you know, the law shall determine the limits of, you know, a freedom of speech, or the law shall determine how much you know, liberty you should have, I don't think that it's this sort of French obsession with the law. It's rather that the law still needs to come into being and to state what this is. Now, I'll end just by saying that there is kind of a very different legal philosophy here too, which is that you know, social naturalism, which isn't a term that I invented. It comes from other you know, historians of 20th century free market thought. I think it works very well for the 18th century. You know, it is this physiocratic idea that if you design the government well and the government is running according to the laws of nature, then you know, Bob's your uncle. Everything's going great. You don't really need to have this adversarial structure of criminal rights that the English have developed, because you know, basically the whole English model of common law rests upon a deep mistrust of government. It's you know, the experience of the Star Chamber. It's the you know, the all of the very different English 17th century history, which doesn't happen in France, that leads to this sort of sense that we always have to be on your guard against government. You know, as Thomas Paine would say, you know, government is a necessary evil. The physiocrats would not subscribe to that idea at all. So you know, they are approaching, and the French, I think, are approaching the idea of rights as being complementary to laws. There shouldn't be this adversarial system in their mind. You should design the state so everything, you know, is a well-oiled machine. Now, today we might think of that as kind of a naive view, but you know, that's because we too have now been, you know, we too have lost some of our innocence in how we think about the state and the power of the state, and probably we're more naturally inclined to be a little disabused of these kinds of notions. But it takes a process of disaffectation to get there. I think the English and the Americans have gotten there earlier due to their different history. And I think that's really what explains why the rights end up being so different in France than they are in the American colonies.
And just to kind of, I guess, follow that line of thinking through that you've just brought up, and just as we really wrap things up here, I'm aware that we're running out of time, but I really just want to finally turn to the legacy of the declarations in the human rights discourse of the 20th and 21st centuries, and the contribution that your work is making to really rethinking this heritage. So there are so many teleological accounts out there that see, you know, the Enlightenment as the birthplace of rights, but you know, what do you think that we stand to gain by realigning the history of rights, not just in terms of intellectual history and rethinking the boundaries of Enlightenment thought, but also with regards to current day human rights discourses? Can you see a kind of contribution to be made there?
So I think that I end up being kind of actually a little pessimistic. I mean, not so much about the future of human rights, and my pessimism isn't so much that this is a lost cause or a last utopia, to borrow Sam Moyne's expression. It's more that I think we suffer from a little bit of wishful thinking, and I think that the attempt even to tie the Universal Declaration just back to the Enlightenment. Now, that's an interesting move because it sort of projects onto the Enlightenment a set of secular values that we're comfortable with. And in so doing, it obscures the fact that even during the Enlightenment, natural law remained a metaphysically grounded discourse. I mean, the physiocrats are very clear on this. I mean, it's a theologically based argument. This only works intellectually if you, in a sort of a metaphysical universe with a God who has, you know, is the prime moral mover, you know, who has established the primary set of natural laws. And I think that what you see in the buildup to the Universal Declaration. So I focus a lot on these leagues of human rights, the Ligue des Droits de l'Homme, in particular the French one, because I think that they've more recently kind of been written out of the history of the Universal Declaration. Sam again has really sort of tried to say that they didn't have any, didn't make any contribution. He's been working more on sort of the Christian aspects of this. But I think that these leagues played a central role. They were demanding these declarations already back in the 20s. They were producing drafts. There's a direct link with certain individuals, René Cassin in particular. So they were really crucial. And the French League, you know, went back. Their charter is the Declaration of the Rights of Man of 1789. So, I mean, it's very explicit. They even wanted not so much to have a new separate declaration, which is what ultimately happened, but just to sort of write a complement. They wanted, you know, part two, let's update the first declaration of 1789 by adding some new rights. And so in their mind, this was very much connected to the efforts of the 18th century. But I think that the problem I see today is that I do think, I'm not claiming originality in this argument, but you know, I think what we know about the Universal Declaration is that they sort of had a whole, they really removed the intellectual scaffolding from it. So there's a lot of weight placed, say, on dignity. You know, dignity is now where we get our rights from. And I think most conspicuously, what disappears is like, well, where do we get our dignity from? You know, this is a very theological concept. And I mean, it also, you know, there've been, of course, lots of books written on dignity. But I think that, you know, basically there's a glaring omission in the Universal Declaration, which is God. And I'm not saying this as a Christian. I'm not a Christian. I'm saying this as an intellectual historian, that we have, you know, removed really the foundation, the traditional foundation for human rights from human rights. Now, this doesn't really bother the lawyers. Like, whatever, we've got this document. It's a legal document. People have signed on to it. It's a contract. We don't really care about the origins of it. And here I'm actually drawing a lot on Chuck Bites' great book on the idea of human rights. But you know, for philosophers, for historians, you know, those of us who are sort of more interested in how these discourses evolve and what their sort of fundamental legitimacy is, I think that's kind of problematic. I don't have an answer because, I mean, you know, the easy answer is to say, well, let's just go back to natural law. And, you know, there are, there's plenty of people, you know, Finnis, Robbie George, who would like to sort of, Mike Pompeo himself, probably our current Secretary of State, who just wrapped up a commission on unalienable rights. You know, lots of people who would like to sort of bring the Christian tradition of natural law back into human rights. And I'm personally very opposed to that, but I kind of see their point because, in a way, human rights is missing its foundation. And so we can all just, you know, agree that it turtles all the way down and that, you know, now these things have a legal existence that, you know, is separate from their historical origin. But, you know, in terms of philosophical legitimacy, I do think we need to do more of the kind of work that Chuck Bites does in his book to, you know, kind of think, well, what is the foundation of human rights today?
Well, on that very powerful point, Dan, we will leave you here. Thank you so much. It has been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. The book is On the Spirit of Rights by Dan Edelstein, published by University of Chicago Press 2018. Dan, thank you so much for being on the channel.
Thank you so much, Alexander. It's a great pleasure.